free societies tend to do a very good job in responding to human needs.
Libertarian intellectual Charles Murray is perhaps America's most influential social policy thinker. Born in 1943 in the small town of Newton, Iowa, Murray spent 6 years in the Peace Corps stationed in Thailand and went on to earn a doctorate in political science from MIT in 1974. Murray started out as a liberal Democrat, but he underwent a political transformation while researching his landmark 1984 book, Losing Ground. The book marshaled overwhelming evidence that American welfare programs were harming the very people they were supposed to be lifting out of poverty.
When you try to do things for other people that they are not prepared to do for themselves, it's very difficult to achieve anything.
Losing Ground was fiercely denounced by the political left, but soon won wide acceptance that the war on poverty was at least partially a failure. The simple fact is, there wouldn't have been welfare reform without Losing Ground. Far more controversial was the bell curve, Murray's 1994 collaboration with Harvard psychologist Richard Herrnstein.
We were convinced that IQ is an important phenomenon in trying to understand what's going on in society.
That book maintained that differences in genes contribute to differences in IQ. Those differences, in turn, play a significant role in the life outcomes of individuals. Most controversially, the book argued that various ethnic groups have distinct, albeit marginal, differences in inherited intelligence.
The commentary on this book shows the bankruptcy of the American media in dealing with difficult topics.
Murray is the author of more than 20 books, including What It Means to Be a Libertarian, a Personal Interpretation. In his new book, Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010, Murray argues that Americans are becoming divided into two distinct classes, and that this growing divide could end American life as we've known it. Murray's analysis focuses on white Americans as a way of highlighting that the negative social trends he identifies do not break along racial or ethnic lines. Murray is currently the W.H. Brady Scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. I sat down with him in March for a wide-ranging discussion of how his prior work has led to Coming Apart. Well, first of all, thank you very much for coming in to talk to us here at Reason.
It's good to see you, Ron. It's been a while.
Yeah, as you know, you're here talking with Reason Magazine, Reason TV. You call yourself a libertarian. What does that mean for you? What do you mean by that?
So I'm a lowercase libertarian. Essentially, I think what Madison thought and what Jefferson thought in terms of the original structure of government and its proper limits. So I'm libertarian on all but the purest of pure things. For example, I'm in favor of drug legalization. I'm not real upset about laws against child pornography and things like that, to just give an example of where I part company with real purists.
In your new book, Coming Apart, The State of White America, 1960 to 2010, is a valedictory, of your long discourse on the intersection between happiness and
public policy. If public policy's purpose is to better enable people to pursue happiness, how does it do it?
And with that in mind, let's start with your first big book.
Losing Ground.
It seems to me in that book you made the following sort of argument, that poverty is like anything else. The more you pay for it, the more you can have of it.
Yeah, the statement I made in the foreword or the introduction of that book was that in the 1960s we changed the rules of the game for low-income people, and especially for low-income young people. And that we changed the rules of the game in the ways that made short-term incentives such that they did really stupid things in the long term.
So basically it was about incentives. People were being given
Indeed
bad
it was.
Incentives.
It was about incentives. And I tried to make the point that a lot of times you don't have to appeal to exotic cultural explanations for why people do things. Just assume that whatever they're doing makes sense to them, at least at the moment they're doing it.
In a recent interview about Losing Ground, you said you argued that you still believe that the reforms of the 60s jump-started a lot of the trends that you currently deplore, and that toothpaste cannot be put back in the tube just by reversing a few welfare state policies. Yet in Losing Ground, you apparently thought you could put some of the toothpaste back in the tube.
I was writing in 1980. And in 1980, you still had, in the white population, for example, you were still looking, I was writing in the early 1980s, you still had out-of-wedlock births in the low teens, I believe, in terms of percentage of births. You still had a culture in which getting married was a strong cultural norm. We're looking at 2012 now. And in 2012, if you take all births in the United States of all races and so forth, you're looking at about 40% of them are out of wedlock. You have seen a change in a cultural norm which has enormous power. In the early 1980s, there was still some stigma, certainly in the white community, associated with having a baby without a husband. That's gone. Effectively, it's gone. A variety of other changes have occurred in sexual behavior, in expectations of women in the workforce. A whole bunch of things have happened, which means that before you can make policy changes that are going to have much effect, you've got to have some cultural changes.
But in Losing Ground, you had hoped at least, and may I quote here, you called for scrapping the entire federal welfare and income support structure, Medicaid, food stamps, unemployment, workers' compensation, subsidized housing, the whole thing.
The whole thing.
And such a step would leave working-age person with no recourse whatsoever except the job market, family members, friends, and public and private, locally funded services. Didn't we get rid of a lot of welfare programs?
No.
Okay.
No. You know, I'm in an odd situation when it comes to the Welfare Reform Act of 1996 because a lot of people say, well, Losing Ground was the intellectual impetus that led to that, which, of course, I want to believe and I want to take credit for it. But I also say the Welfare Reform Act of 1996 bore no relationship to what I was proposing. It was a single program, the AFDC cash program, to which there were changes, and changes that led to a lot of people getting off the welfare rolls, something we could talk about at length as to why that happened. But there remained a big support structure in place. Didn't touch the food stamps program, didn't touch Medicaid, didn't touch public housing, didn't touch a whole bunch of other things. Here's the irony. The left got so excited about the Welfare Reform Act, saying it was going to lead to Calcutta on the Hudson, or which I think was Pat Moynihan's phrase, or something like that. They propagandized welfare recipients saying, you know, the sky is falling, the sky is falling if this thing passed. And when it did pass, they believed them. You had lots of people who left the rolls just after it passed and before anything else had happened. Also, you had lots of people who were working off the books. So they were getting their AFDC and they were holding jobs, and all at once, they couldn't continue working off the books as easily because they were supposed to be putting in efforts to get jobs, and it got kind of awkward when you actually were already holding on to a job. So what you had was, it should have been a lesson for us for lots of other reforms as well. Just make it more of a hassle. You know, if getting assistance were as difficult as getting a driver's license is in some departments of motor vehicles, for example, like the DC department the last time I was there, it's amazing how much we could cut back on recipiency of welfare benefits.
So incentives did matter in that sense.
Sure. Oh, and I still believe incentives matter. What I'm saying in the current book is, we don't have anything in the political landscape that would permit changes that affect incentives enough to produce much of an effect.
Socialist intellectual Michael Harrington critiqued your work in Losing Ground as rather crudely, as he said, the equivalent of a vulgar Marxist, a social theorist who believes in a one-to-one relationship between economic and the political or the psychological. Weren't you actually, in some sense, advocating a kind of economic determinism in that book?
There's a chapter in that book entitled The Destruction of Status Rewards. And The Destruction of Status Rewards said, you know what a lot of these changes in behavior come from? A lot of them come from the fact that it used to be that if you were a low-income guy who was holding down a job and supporting a wife and children, you got status in your community as one of the good guys. And if you didn't do those things, you got stigmatized as one of the bad ones. Well, those are incentives, all right. They're not economic incentives. They're cultural incentives. To say that I am an economic determinist is to have a very selective reading of Losing Ground.
On the other hand, the core of what caused the falling apart, if you will, as I understood it from the book, was the rise of the welfare state, which was all about economic incentives for the most part.
But they affected the status rewards. You know, when you have a change, and this was especially true of the welfare change, it has cascading secondary effects. And the reason I now say, policy changes aren't going to make that much difference is it set in motion all of these other cultural outcomes, including the destruction of status rewards. Including, I would say, the infantilization of males. But that's in concert with the feminist revolution and some other things as well.
The feminist revolution, to a certain extent, has been a great good for women.
Absolutely.
So that part of it isn't inevitable. I think that the status between males and females would have changed.
Well, actually it is. Suppose you have no changes in the welfare rolls. Welfare incentives. Right. Suppose none of the mistakes of the 1960s were made, but you did have the same entry of women into the labor force. Right. Okay, so you have the feminist revolution without any of the policy mistakes. What you would have then in low-income communities are more and more women who are making money on their own. And in a lot of cases, making enough money that it's significant, and they could support the child on their own. So in that sense, you've already got a weakening of the incentive to marry, because economically it's not as crucial as it was before. But another thing happens. Suppose at that point the woman says, well, I still want to get married because my father needs a child. A child needs a father. Okay, so they get married. The guy's position is different now. He's still holding down a job, let's say, but she's making just as much money because she's continuing her job. So yeah, he's helping to put food on the table. That's different from being the man. He's now a partner in this marriage, and I think partnership in marriage is a good idea. So I'm saying, as a father of three daughters, I'm glad the feminist revolution occurred. It inevitably took for low-income men a major prop away from their self-esteem and their dignity. It could not have been otherwise. And that all by itself was going to make a big difference. Then you add on to that the sexual revolution. So the guy, suppose the sexual revolution had not occurred. You had women going into the labor force, but sexual norms were still the same. Well, then the guy would still have a good incentive to marry, because if the only way you're going to get regular sexual access to women is to be married, you're going to get married. Insofar as that's no longer necessary, a big incentive for guys, when they're young, to get married diminishes. That's just the truth about males. What do you suppose the net effect of that is going to be? What's the point of getting married?
So what do you do about that then? You can't take either of those back. It has nothing to do with the incentives of the welfare state at all. It's a huge...
Exactly. So now you go back and say, well, do we have any objective reality on our side? I would submit a major source of satisfaction in life is a good marriage. In order to have a good marriage, you got to get married. So when I'm talking about cultural shifts, I'm not saying we got to make up stuff to try to propagandize people into doing what we want. What we need to do is to start talking more openly about the objective rightness of these behaviors.
On the other hand, the notion of companionate marriage is what I'm taking, that you're thinking about, to some extent or other, is a fairly new notion in human history. If you go back to the 19th century and so forth, one description of marriage is a man and a woman standing back to back, fighting against a force that is trying to destroy their family. Mm-hmm. Those forces went away to a large part in modern society, and they turned on each other instead. And you saw divorce rates increase because people started expecting more from marriage than they were getting. Is that not a plausible part of what also happened during the 1950s and 60s?
First, let's go back to the 19th century and before, when indeed love was not the basis for making marriages. Tocqueville talks about the marriage in 19th century America in some very interesting ways. Specifically, he says, in America, they don't arrange marriages, okay? So they raise the daughters to choose husbands wisely. And that's the way that Americans can get away with marriage, which has such very strict obligations, because they are making marriages with mature decisions. And he has this wonderful passage at the end of the book where he says, to what do I attribute all of these wonderful qualities of the United States? And he says, I attribute it primarily to the superiority of American women. Okay, so you have an institution in the United States in which women still may not have been choosing for love. They were choosing on the basis of people being good providers, good fathers to their children, and so forth. Love in marriage does not consist of this burning desire to jump into bed with each other that you feel at 20 years old. It consists of a shared life and a growing companionship and a depth of human connection that's very difficult to describe to an outsider. I think that developed, I won't say as frequently, because I don't know, but I think that was a very common feature of 19th century marriages.
The next big book, the one that caused you a lot of heartburn, was The Bell Curve. The way I interpret that move from Losing Ground, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, to this is that you went from an incentive explanation for a lot of the things that have gone wrong with American society and growing inequality to one based on more cognitive constraints, that basically the society was sorting on the basis of ability. Would that be a fair sort of description?
That's a good description.
And yet it was the same sort of social problems were being identified with those causes.
Well, if you go to the last chapter of The Bell Curve, you see us address that question directly. We said that what we are doing now is we are creating a world which is congenial to people with high IQs. People with high IQs love complexity. They think complexity is fun. That's why you have Kohlberg at Harvard coming up with his stages of moral reasoning, which has seven stages. At the primitive level, people just think certain things are right and wrong. But at a sophisticated level, you understand that sometimes it's okay to steal in service of a higher good. Okay, that is theoretically true. I even believe it, that it can be okay to steal in service of a higher good. But a kind of moral world governed by that kind of complexity is real hard to deal with if you aren't very smart. It's much simpler if you are, not an intellectual, to have a criminal justice system which is based on very clear, simple, straightforward statements of, if you do this, which is really bad, objectively, you will get a penalty. And what that means is you want a state in which the things that are against the law are things that everybody agrees are bad. Robbery, murder, rape, so forth.
We haven't changed any of those laws, though, as I understand it. Those are all still bad.
And we have 1,000 other things that are also against the law, in which it's not really that obvious that it's so bad.
But very few low IQ people, I suspect, are falling afoul of those new laws, of those complex new tax laws, those complex new
laws against smoking a joint and things like that. Huh? You don't think they're falling afoul of that?
That's true.
Okay. In terms of all kinds of laws, though, including the laws against robbery, rape, murder, and so forth, I evaluated a program in Southside Chicago in the 1970s for chronic juvenile delinquents. And I would talk to kids who were outraged that they'd finally been sent to the can because they would say to me, I'd done things lots worse than that and been caught for them. They didn't do anything to me. Why'd they do anything now? They were looking at a system which behaved utterly irrationally from their point of view. They didn't see it as one which was being forgiving, hoping that they would do better, and finally saying, I guess now we'll have to sanction you. They saw a system that made no sense whatsoever. The same thing has happened with all kinds of aspects of life. The phrase we used in The Bell Curve actually was stolen from Ed Crane. And he said, what you're saying is that everybody has a moral compass, but some of them are more susceptible to magnetic storms than others. I think that's a brilliant avocation of what I'm saying. And what you want to construct is a society in which it is easy for people of a broad range of ability to be morally autonomous. And guess what? That's a libertarian society.
Now, of course, a lot of critics at the time pressed you very hard on the question of racial and ethnic differences in IQ. Nearly 20 years later, do you still see those differences as significant?
Would you tell me anything in the data that has changed in those 20 years? I mean, I've done more research into it since then, and it looks to me like this. The black-white difference in IQ, measurements of which go back to the early 20th century, narrowed substantially for blacks and whites born in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. In the 1930s, it was real big. It was not one standard deviation, to use the technical term. It was closer to two. And it narrowed to about one standard deviation, maybe a little less even, among kids born through the 1960s. Among kids born since the early 1970s, there has been no change in the black-white difference in any data set that I have yet seen. And that does not look good to me. It is consistent with what we said in the Bell Curve. There remains a difference in means. That does not imply that all blacks are less smart than all whites. The significance of group differences is trivial, as long as you treat people as individuals. which of course is the key.
James Heckman, who reviewed your book for the Reason magazine many years ago, said that you hadn't really looked at all the data that you might have, that one of the things that you could do is an intervention that might be successful, and he said he had good data for this, and in fact, very recently he had a further update on this, is you could have early childhood programs, 5 and earlier, where perhaps it might have to have huge effects on cognitive development later, but had huge effects on qualities like industriousness, sharing abilities, that you could inculcate other qualities through education in children that ended up with huge benefits later down the line.
Yeah, and he's using programs like Perry Preschool, correct, with a sample size of 50 in the control group and 40 in the experimental or something like that. Look, Heckman's a serious scholar, and I don't dispute his conclusion that these programs have an effect greater than zero. I would not even go to the mat and say the effects are trivial. I think he is seeing a glass half full that I see half empty. But if you want to spend money on things, early childhood education is going to buy you more than trying to jack up K-12 education, that's for sure. And children who are born into severely disadvantaged circumstances, for my money, you don't have to prove long-term outcomes to say that putting a child from a punishing environment into a nurturing, warm environment is a good thing to do. I hope they have more impact. I think he's more optimistic than the data strictly warrant.
So one of the other things that seemed to be the conclusion of the bell curve is that you were afraid that in some sense rather the cognitive elite that you had identified was going to merge with the affluent, already affluent, and create a new upper class. And I believe that you're arguing that that's actually happened now.
Yeah. People ask me about whether I think the bell curve is still valid. I say, look around. The degree to which we now have a coincidence of the very affluent with the very smart is palpably obvious to everyone. But you can also talk about it more systematically, as I try to do in the new book.
What would you say the thesis of the new book is?
Oh, that's very easy. We have developed classes that are different in kind from anything we have known before. Take the case of marriage. Cultural norm for rich and poor alike back in 1960, almost everybody was married when they were full-grown adults in their 30s and 40s. 94% in the upper middle class, 84% in the working class. You go to 2010, marriage is still alive and well in the upper middle class. About 84% of adults are married in the white upper middle class. It's down to 48% in the white working class. I mean, that's a stunning number. That's a divergence, unlike anything we've ever had before in that sense. Second example, we had neighborhoods in 1960 which were the cliche neighborhoods for where rich people lived. North Shore of Chicago, Beverly Hills, Scarsdale and the rest of Westchester County, Upper East Side, Northwest Washington. You know what the mean income in 14 of those classic rich neighborhoods in 1960 was? It was, expressed in current dollars, today's dollars, $84,000, $83,000, something like that. In other words, half of the people made less than $83,000, $84,000 in today's purchasing power, which means that even in these richest neighborhoods, you had lots of people who didn't have that much money. More importantly, you only had about 26% of them with college degrees. So even the ones who were rich oftentimes were high school graduates. So you know they were fully socialized in mainstream America. Go to 2010, same 14 neighborhoods, $163,000 median income. That's the 2000 census. It's going to be a lot higher now when we get to the 2010 census. 67% with college degrees. A lot of those disproportionately high numbers from the elite colleges. It's very far from mainstream America. And the isolation is not so bad for people who have grown up in working class families or middle class families. It's really problematic when you have people rising to positions of power who have never known anything but that world.
Why is it problematic?
Because they have so much influence on the culture and the politics and the economy of the country. And when you have that kind of influence and you have no real understanding of what the lives of most Americans are like, you tend to do things that screw over the lives of other Americans, intentionally or unintentionally. Most obviously in the case of politics. And when the Tea Party says we got this bunch of intellectual elitist snobs who think they know best how we should live, they got a point. Those people do exist, and that's a kind of separation of Americans into class we've never seen before.
Funny you would say that they think they know best how people should live, because part of what your argument is, as I understand it, is that those people are in fact living the sorts of lives that the lower class should be living. Are you not saying that?
Yeah.
They're staying married, they're working hard.
Yeah, there, a lot of the things they're doing.
So they do know how the other half should live. Is that correct?
Yeah, but they shouldn't be able to make laws. Now, by the way, they are not making laws saying people have to work and people have to get married. They are talking about making laws about what they should eat, so they aren't as fat as they are. They have all sorts of things, with smoking, of course, being the obvious example, of going way beyond protecting people from secondhand smoke and instead sort of trying to enforce that dictum about how people ought to live their lives. There are all sorts of ways in which they are regulating the life out of all kinds of occupations, which prevents people from living their lives as they see fit. Well, the people at the top are not doing a bad job of living their own lives. What I don't want is to give them the power to decide how everybody else should. I would like them to say more openly that we think that the way we're behaving is a good way to live. Say it as a cultural statement of what they consider to be right and wrong. Don't use the power of the state to try to enforce what your opinions are.
I don't know how that would work. I mean, how shall I say this? I go and visit my relatives in Southwest Virginia. I grew up relatively poor on a dairy farm and so forth. And I'm regularly informed that I got above my raisin, that I'm being a snob, if you will. And I'm not sure they want to hear what I have to say about these things.
Well, you know, I get this question.
And by the way, I'm not part of your... I'm not a member of your ecumenical nice people. I do tell people what I think about it. So.
Yeah. But people tell me, you know, I use the phrase in the book that people should preach what they practice.
Right.
And the image is that I want them to go down to low-income communities with bullhorns, you know, and stand in the corner. Look, go back to 1960, when there was an extremely powerful stigma against having a baby without a husband. Incredibly powerful. If you got pregnant and you were in most parts of American society, you went away to visit your relatives for several months and the baby was put up for adoption, you know, it's incredible stigma. Well, how did that come about? I mean, because if you aren't old enough to remember those years, but I am, it was not that people preached on street corners. It was that I was raised so that I knew that if I got my girlfriend pregnant, I'd have to marry her. And I can't even remember the specific times my parents told me that. It was in the air, and it was in the air because it was a cultural consensus. So when I say that a cultural consensus has enormous effects on behavior across the socioeconomic spectrum, I am referring to conditions which have existed in the past and can exist again. Then they will exist when you get conversations started that start with thousands of conversations and eventually grow to millions of conversations and result in a change in the temper of the times. What can you do to foster that? You write books.
On the other hand, that cultural consensus also existed in a world where it was very hard for a woman to support her child on her own, and there was no contraception. Yeah. So expectations were different. So even if you do now go back and preach, you're preaching to a completely different world in many ways.
Okay, now can we get back to the reason that it's premature to talk about solutions with policy? What do you suppose is going to happen to policy if once again there is a cultural consensus that it's terrible for kids and it's terrible for the society to have single births? Lo and behold, all sorts of policy changes in the direction of shifting the concrete incentives will become possible. But until that cultural shift occurs, you can't do a thing. You'll be demonizing single women if you do.
Well, for example, the Republican Party right now seems to be in the process, and the elite media tend to interpret it such, of a war on women, for example.
They say that about Rick Santorum.
I know, Rick Santorum has said that contraception was a bad idea.
And he's getting crushed for it.
deservedly so?
No, he's gotten, I'm just making an observation of fact, that to raise that these days is not only going to get you crushed by the left, you are not going to have people on the right standing up for you either. The politicians across the ideological spectrum are scared stiff of alienating a very large voter bloc, namely women, and more specifically women with children and no guy.
But so women without basically think that the deal they've got now is better than the deal that the cultural conservatives like you perhaps might want them to go back to in the 1960s.
Well, I'm saying that the issue has not been raised in the way it needs to be raised. That you don't do it by saying, let's have a law about contraception. You do it by talking about what happens to children in different family structures. You do it by talking about the objective realities I discussed a while ago. And you don't put it in terms of changing laws. You put it in terms of what's right and wrong.
Started this in 1960. This is when you were a younger man, we'll just say at that point. And to a certain extent, it could sound like, and does sound like in many cases, that you're valorizing your childhood. Is there a kind of confirmation bias by nostalgia that's going into your analysis?
Well, there's part of the book which says, if a time machine could appear that could transport me back to 1960, I would have to be dragged into it kicking and screaming, and I describe the reasons why, because life in many ways now is better than it was then, especially for people like me and people like you. We're doing just fine. Then you can go to a hard-headed empirical examination of the lives of this new lower class I'm talking about. Right? If you say that satisfactions in life, deep satisfactions in life, come from one of four domains, something I've been arguing for years. They come from family, community, vocation, and faith. You don't have to tap into all four. There are happy atheists. There are happy single people. But if you don't tap into those domains, you better have a really satisfying vocation, for example, or you better have a really satisfying community life. Okay. What I'm describing in the new lower class are increasing numbers of people who aren't married. They aren't working. They've fallen away from religion. And they are isolated. They're living in their communities, isolated from any interaction with other people. Those people are living lives that have been stripped of a great deal of the stuff of life. All right? I don't consider that argument to be nostalgic. I say that is grounded in a great deal of our understanding, both in terms of classic Aristotelian discussions of what it means to be a human being, and also modern empirical psychology and sociology. I'm making the statement, this is a human tragedy.
And yet I get the impression that if you gave them the offer, you could go back to 1960, they would also be like you, not want to go. They'd go kicking and screaming.
Yeah. The reason that they aren't going to go back to 1960, part of them are exactly the same reasons I'm not going to, okay? All right. In terms of the creature comforts and the rest of it. The other part of it is that the most impoverished part of all is they don't know there is anything better out there. We have kept that information carefully to ourselves, that if people are watching take away anything, I wish they would take away this. It is non-judgmentalism run amok to say that the person I just described, unmarried, not working, no religion, no community, to say, well, these are his choices, and perhaps in his own way he's just as happy as I am, that doesn't apply to you, is a form of cruelty.
And public policy cannot address this form of cruelty.
We have to address it by a deep introspection into what we most deeply believe about the sources of satisfaction in a human life.
And how do we transmit that? We live it.
We live it openly. And we don't make it easy for people to live miserable lives.
Thank you very much. Glad you could come in and talk about it.
Thanks, Ron. I enjoyed it.